afternoon, this is Michael Collins. I'm going to be leading today's lunchtime learning in the Family Financial Education Series. Today we're going to talk about measuring financial security using the Financial Capability Scale. This call, if you haven't been on these calls for a while or you're new to the Family Financial Education team, includes a brief that's been posted at the website fyi.uwex.edu/financial-series. And there you'll see a link to today's topic, measuring financial security, and then the brief, the financial security scale, or financial capability scale, sorry. So when you open that up, it's a PDF file that will probably open on a different screen, and that's about 4 pages long. And so I'll mainly today be talking through the information that's contained in that brief, as well as some other information that's posted on that website. And then, you know, probably after about 35 minutes or so, I'll pause and see if people have discussion or questions or other kinds of things they want to talk about. But I'm open to questions as we go through as well. Oftentimes, people will keep their phone muted during the first part of the call, which is fine for background noise and that kind of thing. But if you do want to ask a question, just make sure to unmute, and I will hopefully catch you and pause and be able to chime in that way. Just quick logistics things. These calls occur about once a month or so, and we took a little break over the winter holiday, but we'll be back again with March, April, and May. And so at the end of today's call, I will briefly discuss what topics we have coming up. Today's topic is actually a slight variation from our original plan. We're going to talk about the retirement topic, which was planned for today for next month, in part because with the reviews that folks were involved with in their plan of work at the end of the year, a lot of questions came up about measures that we can use in our field to measure how well we are working with people or even diagnose where people are at in terms of their financial capability. So we thought this was an important topic, and I had some feedback from the team. Wanted to try to get this information out, so we kind of bumped some things around to make room for that today. So any questions before I begin? All right. So today I'm going to talk about the Financial Capability Scale, and this is a scale that has been developed here at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, you know, I think is useful in a number of different ways in terms of our work and how we think about financial capability and even, you know, how it makes us think about the kinds of services we're providing. But it's probably, you know, important for folks on this call who are family financial educators who are using the so-called core survey that many financial team members are using, and that core survey contains these questions. So this isn't just a, you know, theoretical scale that, you know, you could think about using. It's a scale that if you're using that survey, you are using. You may not be using it as a scale. You may not be thinking about it as a scale, but those questions are a subset of the questions that are on that 8-question survey actually are very, very similar to the questions that are contained in the scale itself. So you can actually make this scale and use it and think about different ways that it might be useful in sort of diagnosing and even assessing the impact of the work that you do. So I'm going to begin with just generally some background on the Financial Capability Scale and how it evolved. In 2010, the Annie E. Casey Foundation approached the Center for Financial Security at Wisconsin and asked whether there might be a set of tractable measures, and by tractable I mean easy to use measures that could be used in a field setting where clients would self-report how well they're doing. I believe one of the program officers at the foundation even used the analogy to the Cosmo magazine quiz. If you ever look at the grocery checkout line, you see Cosmo has their, you know, 10-question quiz on are you good or that at this or that or the other thing. She sort of said, you know, can we come up with something that would be that quick and easy that people could fill out that would give us a sense of how they're doing. They're doing well, they're doing poorly, and, you know, that's something that could be completed by the client or by the learner in a very short period of time, you know, 1 page or less or a check sheet. And that was the original discussion. And so over the course of about a year, we worked with different organizations, including educators in Wisconsin through Extension, as well as other settings, tax-based organizations in New York, an organization that did employment counseling in Chicago, a group that was doing other kinds of work down in the South. So, you know, different settings where clients were being asked to complete this kind of information as part of the intake process or as part of the serviceability process in some way, where it was collected and then aggregated across organizations to kind of see what patterns and trends might exist. The original process included, I'm guessing about 24 questions, probably between 20 and 24 questions, that were winnowed down based on reactions from practitioners, reactions from clients, reactions from in terms of, you know, were they questions that people actually seem to want to answer? A nice question that nobody wants to answer doesn't help us because a blank doesn't tell us any information. So that sort of helped winnow down the list. And then in the end, the questions, the 5 or 6 questions that we'll talk about today, and the scaling for them were based on comparing what sets of questions seem to be correlated numerically using, you know, real data that was collected from real clients with other behaviors. So the scale that we'll talk about today is correlated with things like savings. It's correlated with things like debt levels. It's correlated with things like credit score. And so to the extent we need a reasonable proxy that tells us how people are doing, that seems to be correlated with other kinds of behaviors in the financial area that we think are interesting, this scale seems to do that. Now, I don't want to oversell the scale. The scale is just what it is. It's a scale that people have answered some questions to, and we've added them up. It's not predictive. It's not saying, you know, who's going to end up in a terrible situation or a positive situation. It's really just an assessment at a given point in time. One metaphor I guess you could use as you think about these kinds of measures is the blood pressure cuff that you do probably every single time you walk into the physician's office. The number on that blood pressure cuff doesn't necessarily tell you anything about how you're doing. The trend from one visit to another might tell you something, but some people have higher levels, some people have lower levels. Yet we collect it every time we go to the doctor's office, knowing that sometimes you go in and you were stressed or you ran there, and so you're going to get a different level than other times when you're more relaxed. Different users might get different measures. But that blood pressure cuff has been around for 150 years. It's been slowly refined and gotten better, and there's some skill in how it's applied. But it has shown us, particularly over time, and in combination with other kinds of measures, certain characteristics that are symptoms of other problems that are potentially diagnostics that help us say whether you're getting better. And there are also ways for us to even look across populations and start to tell how fit people are or how healthy people are. So in the end, it's just, you know, a number over another number, but we've used it in a variety of different settings to help us to target what kinds of services we're doing and to even evaluate the kinds of treatments that are provided to people. We don't have anything close to that in finance. We don't have anything close to a blood pressure cuff, anything that has that long of a history, that's been well validated, that people have been trained in how to use, or even, you know, the equipment necessarily to do that either. So this is a sort of small step towards that vision of the metaphor of a blood pressure cuff, something that we can use on a regular basis that tells us something about where somebody is at today. It may have some, you know, quote-unquote noise to it, so it's going to measure different levels at different points in time across people. But it's a general indicator of how well people are doing in their financial capability. You can think about these kinds of measures as having multiple uses. So one is diagnosis, right? So if somebody comes in and they score really low on the financial capability scale, then that suggests they have more service needs. You know, maybe they need more intensive needs. Maybe they need multiple service needs. Maybe they need referrals to other sources. When people come in at a relatively high level, maybe they're looking more just for information around a particular decision or, in a particular change in life course, those kinds of things. So it can help in terms of diagnosis, thinking about whether we're triaging or diagnosing and matching people to the right services. Another area where the financial capability scale or a scale like this would be useful is around collaboration, where we want to try to take multiple counties who are doing the same kind of work, same kind of general financial capability building work, and you know, maybe slight variations in terms of their programming, but generally with the same goals or similar client base, and try to aggregate up across programs what the impact or what the activities are. And so when we use the same questions in the same format and the same treatment across different clients, that allows us to sort of roll those up and aggregate those up and get a total for a month, for a year, for a location, across locations. And so if we all are measuring different things, different times, then that sort of rolled up, aggregated effort is very, very difficult to do. We need common measures in order to be able to do that kind of reporting and advocacy around what a collection of programs are doing. And then finally, there's a potential for a scale like this to be useful in assessment, measuring at time one and time two, at pre and post, for example, or pre, during, post, maybe multiple points in time. Maybe every time we visit with a client, we measure it. But it gives us a sense of whether people are getting better or worse. And, for some measures, they may get a little bit worse, depending on what the program is and what their status is. And other programs, they may, over time, particularly over a longer run period of time, tend to get better. So you want a measure that moves over time. You want a measure where everybody doesn't start at the very top of the scale, because then there's no room for upward movement. And so all those things were sort of taken into consideration as this scale was developed. The scale itself is still very, very new. There's no real user group out there, I guess you would say. So I can't point to say, this large national effort is using the scale or anything like that. We don't have the equivalent of a big major federal agency sanctioning the use of this scale. One of the models that was used in developing the financial capability scale was the Department of Agriculture, or USDA, food security scale, which is a very, very similar instrument, the self-reported instrument that individuals will answer about themselves and their families to assess how food insecure they might be. And there's variations on the food security scale, including child food insecurity and other kinds of more severe measures of whether people are getting adequate nutrition in their household. But that idea of a simple measure that is useful in serving as a proxy for hunger, as a proxy for whether people are getting food levels, was in some ways the idea behind this as well. It's a proxy for how well people are doing in their financial lives, just like the food security scale is a proxy for how well people are dealing with food and nutrition issues. So those of you who are nutrition educators or familiar with the nutrition education area may know about the food security scale. And it's, again, a relatively short set of questions that can be aggregated and to put people into different buckets of how food insecure they might be. The similar model with the financial capability scale, we can't directly, much like we can't directly measure sometimes caloric intake for families, we can't directly measure financial capability. We don't know what you're capable of. We have a hard time. Even if we have information about, say, your bank balance or your debt levels, it's hard to know whether they're good or bad. So somebody could have low bank balances but manage their finances and have very strong financial capability and do just fine. Other people may have very high debt levels, but it's because they've invested in a business or a home or other activities, education. And that, again, may be an indicator of they're doing just fine. And so it's hard to categorize people and say, it's always true if you have more savings, you're better off, or it's always true if you have less debt, you're better off. It kind of depends upon the context of the client. So this measure is intended to try to capture a breadth of different activities that people may take part in. It's very focused on basic financial capability, so things like paying bills and basic planning tasks, as opposed to, some more grandiose goal that might be part of why what a counseling, coaching, or education program is doing, say, for example, retirement planning or something like that. It's much more about basic financial education and basic financial capability. One of the key things that we always struggle with a scale like this is what is truth. So if the financial capability scale says a number, say 6, and that number correlates with something else, do we really think that that tells us that the scale is valid, that it tells us that it's measuring some underlying thing that's of importance? And we've tried to compare the results of the financial capability scale to other kinds of behaviors. So savings is one, debt levels is another, credit report is another, having a financial plan is another. So a whole series of different sort of related behaviors, which any one of which we might say for any one client may or may not be a symbol of or a proxy of being financial capable. But when we aggregate across hundreds of clients, it starts to tell a story where there's a pattern of the direction of the scale, the higher low level of the scale, and the higher low level of things like savings and debt and credit report items. That begins to tell a story that we think is reassuring. It says that this is a measure that is valid. It does reflect current financial status. It does seem to be correlated with some of the things that we think matter in terms of people's financial capability. So that validity is a key part of why we think this is a good measure, and the fact that it's able to be completed in a short period of time by clients in the field is a real advantage, because it's things like credit reports or savings balances are really hard to collect with any accuracy. To ask people to dig up their bank statements, and if they have multiple accounts and then you have to aggregate across them, it becomes very, very challenging. Whereas a simple, multiple choice, one-page survey form is much more doable in a field setting. The other thing we care about with a scale like this is whether it's reliable. And that is, if you take the same set of scale questions, if you take the same test more than once in a short period of time when very little other things change, you ought to score pretty similarly. So if you had some shock, then yeah, it might go up or down. But if you're you and you answered these questions and a week later you're still you and not a lot of change, you answered these questions, it ought to have similar responses over time. So we want a scale that seems like it is consistent over time. It's not too noisy. That's sort of the quasi-statistical term that we think about. Does it have a lot of highs and lows that are unrelated to whatever it is we're trying to measure? And this seems like it doesn't have a high degree of noise, that people, it doesn't have a lot of volatility, that people tend to answer it pretty consistently over time, unless things change. And when things change, the direction seems consistent with the kinds of validity tests that I talked about earlier. We also don't want a scale, though, that everybody answers exactly the same. So if everybody always got a 5 every time, then that scale doesn't tell us anything. So we're looking for a scale that has some range of responses, where some people are high and some are low, and that changes over time, but still has some reliability in that each person without a lot of other changes answers pretty consistently over time. The other thing we worry about in terms of reliability with a scale like this is that we have essentially 5 or 6 questions which are related to each other. And so we don't want to ask the same question twice. So if I ask you the same question 10 times and you answered it 10 times exactly the same way, that would seem like it's pretty reliable. That's not very helpful, because after the first time you answered that question, it didn't tell us any new information. We do want a set of questions that each question in the scale tells us something unique, but collectively the sets of items in the scale tell us something that's useful. And so the challenge of any kind of a scale like this is developing something that tells us, as efficiently as possible, by answering the fewest number of questions as possible, something that is important and something that is unique. And that's a struggle, particularly in finance, because there is such variation as to whether, sometimes your best option isn't to pay all your bills on time. Sometimes your best option isn't to always save. And so these kinds of measures, these kinds of scales, tend to be kind of unreliable in that they are, that any individual responses to the set of questions will have a range of different answers to them. And so we have come up with a scale that's pretty good, but if you were to look at a scale in psychology or health, other kinds of areas where there's much more precision to what we're measuring, those measures tend to come up to be much more internally reliable. People will answer all the questions in a more consistent fashion. And that's just one of those things we're struggling with this field, is that we have a measure that's pretty good, but it's not perfect. And so I think over time we'll begin to see more scales develop that have maybe even better statistical properties than this one. But for the time being, this is kind of the best we can do. And so what we've got is a scale that has six questions that are covering five or six different constructs. And by a construct, I mean, like a behavior or a capability, an underlying thing that's being measured. And so the first of these constructs is around budgeting. And some of you are no doubt rolling your eyes because you don't like budgeting. You prefer spending plan or, you know, some other term. And in fact, in the question, as I'll get to it later, it's not just about budgeting. But why we think that budgeting concept is important is because whether you call it a budgeting or spending plan or even a financial plan, it's that you're thinking about the future. It's what we're the underlying thing we're trying to measure is future orientation. Are you thinking about the future? Do you have some plan, whether it's written or unwritten, about how you're going to get there? So budgeting takes some planning. Having a financial plan takes some planning. Having a spending plan takes some planning. And so that planning, that active planning, that active thinking about the future and having a future orientation, that's really what we're trying to measure. And so the question has the word budgeting in it, and sometimes people get caught up in that. But what we care about is that looking towards the future and about thinking about what kinds of steps you need to take to get towards the future in a positive way. The second set of constructs is really around goals. We've tried this scale with lots of variations here of writing down a financial goal, asking if you have a financial goal or not, analyzing whether your financial goal is short or long, what components of the financial goal there might be. And it turns out most people do have a financial goal, and most people have a financial goal that is relatively specific. They may not put a dollar value or a date on it necessarily, but they have some direction that they're headed in. What turns out to be more important than having a goal or not, again, because most people do have some kind of goal, is how confident you are in your ability to achieve your goal. So having the goal itself is a signal of being future-oriented, to thinking about the future, much like the budgeting measure I talked about just a second ago. But this subjective sense of can I do it, this subjective capability, is really quite powerful. That how well do I think I can do in achieving that goal? Do I feel like that goal is sort of fantasy, or do I feel like that goal is something that I can get done? And that's a real different kind of issue. And the question in this case is really just about the subjective confidence in achieving your financial goals, whatever they might be. And that is what we're trying to measure with this particular question, is how much you think that you can do towards achieving your goal. Now, it's important to note that sometimes people have an unrealistic confidence in how well they're going to do. And once they take part in a program, especially an education program, and they realize something that maybe they thought was simple isn't so simple, their confidence goes down, at least in the short run. And that's sort of the nature of how people's financial capability evolves, is once they understand the complexity of some of these issues, maybe something that they ignored and didn't pay a lot of attention to before, becomes more clear, then they start to struggle more. And so we'll see sometimes this goal confidence decline with particularly initial program intervention. Over time, we think it'll rise, but there may be a short-run effect of this item in the scale being depressed. It's not that dissimilar than, you know, a blood pressure cuff. In one particular moment, you might come in and be stressed and get a higher reading, but over time, the trend line in that is what we're more concerned about than any one given measurement. The next question we have is around using auto deposit or auto savings, and some variations even auto bill payment. And there's lots of good reasons for not using automatic payments. And I've heard those, and I understand, you know, sometimes people need more control or more granularity over their payments. And that's fine. But on average, people who tend to set up automatic payments, automatic deposits, automatic savings, are recognizing that if they don't do that, it won't happen. They recognize that they have self-control failures. They recognize that if they don't pay themselves first, which is sort of the common lingo when we think about automated savings, it won't happen. And what the key construct that we're trying to measure with this question is really around, do I recognize that I have to automate things or else I'll fail to do it? So it's that automation to overcome my own failures. So this recognizing that is partly why this question is in here. Another key construct that's in here, a question, is around emergency funds. And again, you may argue that you know, people don't have an emergency fund at any one given time, especially if they just had an emergency, then they depleted their fund. That doesn't mean that they're not financially capable. The fact that they had the fund avoided some hardship, so that's a good thing. But why they're asking a question about an emergency fund is important is that, it's a notion of not only am I planning and thinking about the future, but am I recognizing that I need to anticipate contingencies, that there may be bumps in the road, that I need to have a rainy day fund to avoid a hardship, and that if I don't have that planning in place, then when negative things happen, I may not be able to manage that problem, and I may end up being in a worse situation. So it's different from budgeting. It's different from just a future orientation. It's really thinking ahead about particularly negative contingencies that can happen, although people may be anticipating positive contingencies as well. But it's sort of, are they thinking ahead so that they can avoid that problem? And so having an emergency fund is one signal or one proxy for thinking ahead and being planful about that potential problem that could occur. One of the questions is just around spending. And so it's whether your spending is less than your income. Again, this is one we tested, the spending more than your income, equal to your income, so different ways of testing this. And it turned out that this was the one that people could reliably measure or reliably answer in a consistent way. But what we're trying to get at here is really whether people are paying attention. Do they know that their spending level has a limit on it, and that's how much they make? And, you know, if they're spending more than their income or spending exactly the same, that's a different kind of a response. So what we really care about in this question is if they're spending less than their income. When we did the scale with spending more than income, we actually got very similar results, but it seems like people were had an easier time thinking about this particular answer. And this is important because it tells us that you're paying attention. You can't answer this question reliably if you don't know that you're spending less than your income. You're not getting into a situation where you're spending future income. And so this is, again, about being mindful and about paying attention, and that's the underlying construct that we're trying to measure. The last question is here about paying a late fee. And again, there's a multiple testing we've done of, do you pay a bill late versus do you pay a late fee? People tend to be a little bit better about concretely saying, yes, I paid a fee. Paying a bill late may have more of a negative connotation to it, but paying a late fee, people are much more objective about, which may seem a little silly, but, the fee is something people remember and they can recall and seem to answer in a pretty clear way. We've actually tested that question against credit reports, and in fact, when people say they do, they do. So it's seems to be a fairly valid measure of this particular behavior. But why we care about this behavior of paying a late fee is that it's a proxy for planning, for paying attention, for not letting things slide. And it's also one of the key items in the credit score. So it's one of those things that we think matters in terms of people's financial capability, and it matters in terms of financial access as well. So there are some good reasons that this is here, both from a practical standpoint as well as the underlying construct that's being measured. So those are the major constructs, sort of the five or six, depending on how you want to break out the goals and goal confidence, different categories of underlying behaviors or underlying attitudes that we're trying to measure. So the next question is, how do we take those areas and make them into a scale? What are the questions that we ask, and then how do we put points on those questions in order to add them up and come up with a one number that summarizes financial capability? And that's what the FCS, or Financial Capability Scale, tries to do. It's on page 3 of the brief. Those questions are listed, and I'll just read through them and quickly talk about the scoring. I don't expect out of this call that you'll be able to run out and do this, but at least you get a sense of a flavor of how this works. And the order of this question, these questions has been pretty consistently used over time. We haven't really experimented with variations in the order. I'm not sure that it would matter, but the order I'm going to describe them to you is the order they've generally been used in the past, and should come up with consistent results over time. So the first question is just simply, do you currently have a personal budget spending plan or financial plan? And they get 1 point if it's yes and no points if it's no. There are variations on this where in the last 30 days or in the last 3 months that have been used. That's really a programmatic call, less than a scale call. So if you're consistently using those time frames across all these questions And especially if you're trying to use these questions in a way to look backwards, how people have done since the program occurred. So I know in the core survey for extension educators, if you're using that, there's a lot of references of the last 3 months. And that's because the core survey is set up to automatically be sent out to people after 3 months. So that was intentional, that time frame, because that's the time gap that's between the initial and the follow-up of the survey. But there's nothing, you could say currently, you could say 30 days, you could, you know, depending on how you're using it, what the context might be. But the current version has this currently, and that's sort of contemporaneously trying to measure, do they have a budget or not. So that's question one. Question two is, how confident are you in your ability to achieve a financial goal that you set for yourself today? They get 0 points if they say not at all. They get 1 point if they say somewhat confident, and 2 points if they say very confident. Again, we've tried it with different scales. People tend to glom around either end in the middle, so we just eliminated all the other noise and just said there's a, you know, a not at all, a very, and an in-between, and that's what this particular question measures. The third question is the emergency savings question. It says, if you had an unexpected expense or someone in your family lost a job, got sick, or had another emergency, how confident are you that your family could come up with the money to make ends meet within a month, so within 30 days roughly? And again, it's three items that they can answer, 0 for not at all, 1 for somewhat, and 2 for very. And again, this is how confident, so not at all confident, somewhat confident, or very confident, so they could make ends meet. Obviously, if you changed it from within a month to 5 days, or a day, or, you know, different time frames, you would get slightly different responses on this. We've tended to like the 1 month time frame. Most people think about their budget in a sort of monthly way. It's one budget cycle. So that's one way that people naturally think about their finances. If you get into more granularity of time, people might be a little more panicked, and obviously it will be harder to do. But again, that's one of those things that certainly could be altered if the scale were used in different settings. The fourth question is, do you currently have an automatic deposit or electronic transfer set up to put money away for a future use? And then in parentheses, such as savings. One is yes, and 0 is no. So if they say no, they get no points for this one. Variations we've seen in this are that, you know, maybe it doesn't say such as savings, or, you know, bill payment may be another one. Those tend to just increase the number of people who say yes, but we still get variation. There's a lot of people who don't do any kind of automatic payments. As I said before, on average, we think that's a good indicator of people recognizing their self-control problems if they have discretion over these things. The fifth question is, over the past month, would you say your family's spending on living expenses was less than its total income? 1 is yes, and 0 is no. Again, we think this is a month-long period is about what people think about in terms of their budget, and so that tends to be a period that people can think about in a relatively easy way. And the last question, question 6, is, in the last 2 months, have you paid a late fee on a loan or bill? And yes is 0, and no is 1. Notice that's the opposite of all the other yeses and nos. Here, you get 1 if you say no, if you haven't paid a late fee. Again, this is 2 months. You might want to do this as a month. But one of the reasons why this is 2 months is a lot of billing cycles are longer than a month, or with the grace period, essentially, it might go beyond a month. So we want really people to think about their last set of cycles on bills, which, you know, maybe some they just paid and some that they paid at the last part of that cycle, and so it sort of hopefully encompasses all the bills that are due in any one given period. There have been variations on this where scales have included more items, or where the point differences are a little bit changed a little bit, or even the time frames, as I mentioned, are changed a little bit. These tend to make it harder, obviously, or maybe impossible to combine results across programs, but they still generally follow the patterns that I'll talk about in just a minute. So don't sweat it if the version that you've been using has slightly different wording. It still has the same kind of properties, I think, overall. So I want to talk just quickly, before I open it up for discussion and questions, about why we think this is a pretty good scale. These numerical measures, when we add those points up, which is essentially an 8-point scale, are correlated with things like credit score. You know, somebody who has a FCS of 3 or under has a lower credit score. Somebody who has an FCS of 6 or higher has a higher credit score. You'll see on the FYI website there's an update where I tell you an example of a scale. You can see some charts there that I made using some data. We collected data from about 1,200 people nationally, and you know, the asset levels are higher for the higher FCS people. The level of emergency savings are higher for the higher FCS people. Financial stress is lower for the high FCS people, and the debt levels are slightly lower for the high FCS people. So, again, there's a general pattern that is consistent with the scale being correlated with other behaviors that we think are a test of the validity. Turning to how this is being used with an extension, again, this is part of that standardized core 8-question survey that many financial educators are using. There's a figure in the brief that shows the growth of the use of that survey since 2012. So it's not quite doubled, but almost doubled every year. So we've, the most current year, we had almost 500 of these surveys completed across the state. And, you know, anticipating that as 2015 rolls out, we've already seen some come in, that number will continue to expand over time as well. You know, I think we've also had the opportunity within the use of the scale or of the core survey to look at how the FCS scale changes over time. And so you'll see in figure 2 in the brief the average scale number for people at intake when they first take the survey as part of their extension program, and then at follow-up. And on average, it increases about two-thirds of a point, about half to two-thirds of a point. And so we see that scale going up with that follow-up. Generally, these are 3-month follow-ups. Probably two-thirds are occurring via an email that's going out automated for those of you who've been entering emails in for your clients. And in some cases, it's being entered, hand-entered, based on a paper version from those counties that are doing their own follow-up. But, you know, this is, I think, a good signal that after 3 months, the scale is increasing. And the figure 3 in the brief actually breaks down a little bit where that change is coming from, what components of the scale are moving the most. And you'll see that the, you know, budgeting increases quite a bit, using auto deposit increases, emergency fund increases. You know, spending less than income, we don't see that move as much. As you can imagine, that's a harder thing for people to control. No late fees, we see some improvement there. Again, you can imagine that may be a little bit harder for people to control. And then confidence, as I said before, actually seems to go down just a little bit. It's actually not statistically significant. Confidence is the same. But some people are clearly less confident after taking part in the service. So, you know, were we to do a 6-month follow-up instead of a 3-month follow-up, maybe we'd see that shift in a different direction. You know, we might start to see more effect there. But still, I think in general, the overall scale is what we care about, the aggregated scale. And that movement certainly is a positive indicator of the work that educators are doing. It also suggests that people are, at least used based on the measures in this scale, in a challenging position. You know, most of the average, I think, at intake is about 3.5. So that's, you know, 3 and below is sort of where we would begin to say there's a lot of correlations with negative financial issues, meaning high debt, and, mispayments, lower credit score. So that's probably consistent with the client that you're thinking about as well. So it does help us a little bit in terms of thinking about diagnosis of who the clients are that are coming in for extension services and what kinds of issues that they might be facing. So I'll stop there. I mean, I think in general, the goal of this call was just to make you familiar with what the scale is. Even if you're familiar with the survey, maybe you're not thinking about it as a scale, at least some of the items on the survey as being part of a scale. You know, the goal is something that's easy to use in the field, that is a proxy for other behaviors that can be tracked over time. It certainly isn't the end-all be-all, so there are lots of programs that collect this in addition to things like savings levels or a credit report or other kinds of items that are important to them. It's really a complement. It's not meant to substitute or replace other kinds of measures, but hopefully it's something that can be aggregated and to help tell a story of collective action, as well as help both diagnose and assess individual client outcomes as well. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to take questions, comments, discussion. as we go forward. The other thing I want to highlight is, in addition to the example of the correlations of the SDS to other behaviors, there is a background link to the food security scale that the USDA puts out there. And so that is a well-tested scale. It's been around for a long time, so you can get a sense of how that's been used in the USDA setting as well. So I'll stop there. Thanks very much. Any questions or discussion? All right, hearing none, I will throw it open. If anybody wants to email me, they're welcome to do that. My email address is on the Lunch Time Learning website. Our next call will be on March 16th. We're going to talk about retirement and estate planning basics. That was originally scheduled for today, but we'll tackle that next. In April, we're going to talk about financial coaching, and particularly the A4 model that maybe you've heard a little bit more of, a structured approach to financial coaching. And then in May, on May 18th, we'll talk about books that are currently out, new books that have been released, and we'll ask some of you to take part in that discussion and bring some books that you have come across that you think would be helpful for other educators to hear about and summarize those for the rest of those on the call. So thanks so much, everybody, and have a great week.